This is episode 3 of Silence is Violence, Stories of Financial Education. As I mentioned in the last episode, I'm a visiting scholar at NEFI. And in this episode, we are bringing you into the research fold. You get to be a fly on the wall as I, along with two good friends and fellow researchers, discuss my research on the financial trauma experienced by Black women in the city of St. Paul, Minnesota. We explore how financial education and addressing financial trauma can help address wealth inequality, drawing on existing research and the lived experiences of the Black women from St. Paul who participated in the study. In this episode, I am joined by the wonderful Dr. Josh Caraballo and Dr. Michael Dedman. Josh is the Managing Director of Research at NEFI, and Michael is the Research Director at NEFI. Together, we will discuss the delicate balance between acknowledging financial trauma and pushing for wealth justice, drawing on research and personal stories to highlight ways forward. Before we get into episode 3, I think it's important to walk through the evolution of my definition of financial trauma. My earliest conceptual definition of financial trauma from 2020 is the response to the cumulative harming of a person's wealth-building capability caused by events, actions, policies, and cultural messages that inequitably reinforce a person's socioeconomic condition or positioning. In 2021, I posited an alternative definition: the effect of being required to experience economic violence for financial abuse, financial shaming, and/or chronic financial stress in order to build material wealth. The next iteration of the concept emphasized the fact that financial trauma is not just a single response to participation in the economy, but rather it's an experience that often happens repeatedly and cyclically. Defining financial trauma as a cycle of triggers and reactions that limits a person's ability to build wealth helped uncover that the traumatization of certain groups is self-perpetuating. In 2023, I maintained that the goal of the American economic system is still to limit, if not completely eliminate, certain groups' opportunities to fully participate in the national economy. To achieve this goal, the institutionalization of financial trauma as an experience when interacting with the system is necessary. And I said this is the idea: make it so painful, scary, and/or destructive to fully participate in the national economy so that many will not want to fully participate. Limiting participation leads to suppressed wealth. This discovery led me to develop a measure for non-participation in the economy, which I named as an indicator of financial trauma. But the most recent iteration of my definition of financial trauma again decisively emphasizes the role of the economic system and its architects as the perpetrators of the violence and trauma that is then experienced by groups of people, especially minoritized and marginalized people. Because of this, another way to define financial trauma is as the effect of being systematically exploited, harmed, and/or betrayed by an economic system and its institutions, which then ensures the continued concentration of wealth and power in the few, namely those who enjoy racial, gender, class, and ability privileges. Simply, financial traumatization has the purpose of perpetuating wealth inequality. It is not inadvertent, nor is it an unfortunate externality. It is a deliberate tactic to realize the original aim of the American economic system, like we went over in episode 1, to concentrate wealth, resources, and/or power in the few. I'll also reference a research study that I conducted in 2024. When this episode was being recorded, I was in the middle of analysis. The study looks at the role of gender as a driver of financial trauma. Specifically, it engages Black women in St. Paul, Minnesota. The study aimed to understand and evaluate how Black women make meaning of and navigate through the lasting effects of financial trauma as they transition from girlhood to womanhood in St. Paul, Minnesota. Even though there is no universal socioeconomic experience for Black women, the study revealed that the experience of Black girlhood is deeply intertwined with trauma, including financial trauma, and the report we are creating asserts that there has been an insufficient examination of how the multitude of individual and systemic abuses and traumas perpetrated against Black girls become core memories that shape their relationships with money, value, wealth, and worth when they transition to Black womanhood. The study also found that the concept of mother work was deeply intertwined with Black women's experiences. Beyond caring for their kin, this mother work or other mothering, which was coined by Patricia Hill Collins in 2000, is the practice of striving to uplift your community through social activism and other means of communal care. And this act of caring and participating in the mother work exacerbates financial trauma. One of the primary ways our participant partners are making meaning of and navigating financial trauma is through their pursuit of doing this mother work. And we found that when the ability to do this work is disrupted, it generates financial shame. It prolongs their ability to heal, and it makes breaking free from the cycle of financial trauma feel wholly unattainable. We hope this research encourages anyone who supports Black women, specifically in terms of financial education, to understand that they have a responsibility to support Black women's pursuit to heal and to help them release themselves from the belief that I should have known better. We also hope it exposes the cyclical nature of financial trauma and the oppressive systems and harmful social constructs that perpetually reinforce it. In this episode, you'll get a peek into some of these key insights, and we hope you'll check out the report when it is published later this year. We definitely get more academic in this episode, so feel free to pause, rewind, reach out if you have any questions on what we discuss and what we dig into. I really hope you enjoy it and enjoy seeing how the sausage gets made. The gang is all back together, as it were, and I'm really excited to have this conversation. We kind of get to sit in our own nerdiness to really break down some of the major themes that we've been grappling with really over the last year. Throughout the last couple of episodes, we've really been exploring the history of financial education, kind of some of its oppressive origins and how that is entangled up in this kind of web of, yes, financial education is important and necessary. And at the same time, there are reasons why we feel as though we need to push it in a direction to make sure that it's no longer doing harm and maximizing impact and doing the most good. And so I thought that that particular tentacle and thread throughout the series is particularly exciting and interesting in the work that we've been doing over the last year as it pertains to our study of Black women's financial trauma in St. Paul. And so I am totally pleased to invite Josh and Michael into the space. And so I'd love for you all to introduce yourself to our audience. And Josh, you can start.
Well, thank you so much. Really a pleasure to be a part of this discussion. My name is Joshua Caraballo. I am the Managing Director of Research at NIFI. And my background is in industrial organizational psychology.
And Michael.
Hi, I'm J. Michael Dedman. I'm the Research Director at NIFI. I've been here for about 18 months, and I came to NIFI with a background at a financial coaching organization. That's sort of where I started in this field of financial education, financial well-being. I'm a political scientist by training, finishing a PhD in political science at Syracuse University, where I focus on political economy, financial well-being, economic well-being, and things related to that, and have so loved working on this project with you, Chloe, and I'm excited to just let the juices flow in this conversation as we kind of wrap up in a lot of ways what's been a really fulfilling project, I know, for NIFI.
Yes. So in summary, we are in our best land of nerdiness, where we kind of get to bring these really interesting perspectives to our work together. So again, our audience knows that I consider myself a traumographer, this, you know, made up term of what I do to map the geographic spread of financial trauma. So to bring in the lens of Michael, your kind of political economy, political science background, and Josh, your psychology brain, I think is going to create this really interesting conversation for us, which, you know, we always say we'd love for people to be flies on the wall. And so this is the opportunity to do so. Before we dive into the actual data that we've been chewing on, how would you ultimately define financial education? Where do you feel it's been? Where do you feel it's going? And why do you feel as though this is something that is necessary to dedicate your work to?
It's a really rich question. And what's interesting is that Josh and I, you know, both come from different backgrounds. we approach this sort of from different perspectives. And I think that's been a really fulfilling part, I think, of this project, is that the three of us are sort of coming from like distinct, but obviously really related sort of approaches. Coming from a political science and a political economy background, my research specifically focuses on the politics of economic crisis, asking questions of who is it that suffers the most when especially advanced economies, complicated and dynamic economies like the U.S. economy, run into crisis. Who really suffers in those moments of crisis? What are the tools that the state in particular, but also civil society, nonprofits, NGOs, community organizations, what are the tools that they use to try to cushion the blow of economic crisis on households and individuals? And how do those work? And also particularly asking, like, how do they not work? How are people left out of those different elements of the social safety net? How does that interact with racial and gender inequality, the sort of history and legacy of systemic inequality in the United States in particular? And then also asking questions like, what's the ultimate outcome of those crises, especially when communities are left behind or not really protected or supported in those moments of crisis? I ask that question politically in my own sort of research, but in my work at NEFI, I really think a lot about the really dynamic nature of financial and economic well-being. You know, how does that really look at the individual level and at the household level? The things that people feel are important to them beyond just their objective financial and economic circumstances, you know, their sense of dignity, their sense of psychological and emotional well-being as well. And so what really kind of drew me both into this field, but also to the work at NEFI, is to really think about how the actually existing set of social and community services that are out there, how do they respond, right, at the actual metro community neighborhood level? And in a lot of communities in the U.S., the sort of financial education, financial security, asset building field plays a really important frontline role in that. You know, it's a really interdisciplinary field that we're in. And there's a lot of social workers and educators that have taken up sort of the burden or try to take up the burden of being a frontline response, especially in moments of crisis. And I'm really interested in thinking about how the financial education or the asset building and financial security field in general has dealt with essentially by default becoming the sort of first responders in many ways to those problems, but also like the ways in which that really does not work very well, right? There's a lot of reasons why we wouldn't want to set up a system like that from first principles. And that, I think, then implicates our research about how is financial education one potential solution to some of these issues that people face, but where are the gaps? How does it continue to fall short? And how can, you know, organizations like NEFI play a role in trying to address some of those persistent shortcomings? So that's really kind of where I'm coming from and what I'm bringing to the table, I guess, in terms of my perspective.
Yes, thank you. And Josh, what are your thoughts? Financial education, how that situates itself in the work and the perspective that you bring?
Yes, absolutely. There are differences in our backgrounds and trainings. However, we're looking at coming together for the same outcomes. So I think it's such a beautiful way of looking at financial education and research in general. One of the things I learned early on in my training was that interdisciplinary work is really important, and that a lot of the research, especially for IO or industrial organizational psychology, is inherently interdisciplinary. And so I was taught from early on that whatever stream I decide to be in, it's important for me to look outside that stream to see what else has been done. And I carry that with me with all that I do. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, especially when it comes to financial education. And we look at things like NEFI's personal finance ecosystem, or the PFE, which to me, it really warms my heart because there's so many aspects of that interdisciplinary style, if you will, that can be tapped into.
The PFE you just heard us talking about is the Personal Financial Ecosystem. It is a visual roadmap and framework that lays out the foundational factors of an individual's state of financial well-being. NEFI developed it to demonstrate financial education's role in an individual's financial well-being within a broader environment. It gives context to the factors that influence financial well-being and manages expectations for what interventions and efforts aimed at influencing financial well-being can realistically achieve.
From a psychological standpoint specifically, there are books like Morgan Housel's The Psychology of Money, which I think pretty much encapsulates how I feel about financial education, generally speaking. So it's not to really just say, oh, go and read that book instead of me talking to it. But he did such a wonderful job of encapsulating all the thoughts and ideas and research that when I was reading it, every time I turned the page, I was like, wow, that's how I feel. That resonates with me. So all of those teachable moments, if you will, were important for me to really give perspective as to how I feel about the field. Also, what IO psychology has helped me understand is that education, generally speaking, but especially for financial education, needs to come from multiple sources, and it needs to happen at multiple times in your life in order to really stick. The other thing about IO psychology, which might surprise some people, is that it's not only done at the individual level. We were trained to do it simultaneously at three levels. So you have the micro, the meso, and the macro. And we can translate that into, we're really talking about the individual, which is usually what psychology is thought about, is that we're just focusing on the individual. But that is not the case with business psychology. And then, of course, you have the group, the community, and then society or the global level as well. One last thing I'll mention, because I think it's really important, is back to the interdisciplinary sort of way that we look at things. We talk about something like educational inequities, right, that take place. You can't have that discussion without talking about health inequities. And we can go into the aspects as to why that's so. But Chloe, obviously, your work hits on this really well, and the literature review that we did together, as well as the outcomes of the data that we'll talk about. And you can't talk about health inequities without talking about environmental and economic justice, right? So it's like, how do we take all the things that we do know about low income, poverty, low resource places, greater health disparities, historical racism and oppression, and lump that all together to help us better understand how we can create effective financial education that really makes a difference in people's lives, understanding at the end of the day that it is not a panacea that will wipe away all the troubles that people or issues that people face, that in fact, we need to go back to something like the ecosystem, which NEFI is so proud to have as a resource for people, so that we can truly understand all the nuances and elements that are at work to help people reach financial well-being, knowing that it is not a destination, that is something that we work on each and every day that we wake up and have the opportunity to better our lives.
Yes. What a great way to kind of ground ourselves before now actually kind of diving into the work and the stories and the experiences that we've been able to collect as data. I think about how when we started the research project itself, we knew why we wanted to focus and centralize our study on Black women, but I think your backgrounds and, again, the interdisciplinary nature, the, you know, why does financial education even need to exist, particularly in contexts of crises, of failures, of support, right, from a societal perspective, to Michael's point, is that Black women are kind of a real embodiment of all of these complexities and nuances of how different forms of oppression kind of interlock and create the conditions for our lives. And because Black women are situated in a place where they have kind of, some Black feminist scholars call them, you know, double vulnerabilities or multiple vulnerabilities because of both their racial identity, their gender identity, and then, of course, we can include class in that in certain situations. It's really important to bring to the fore of why we chose this population to begin with. And so what we just discussed is kind of the perfect way of grounding ourselves. And to that end, I wanted to also, again, before we dive in more deeply, this is something that we asked ourselves from the beginning, and I think was borne out in the data itself, which is one of the big themes that we hypothesized would be there is, one, what is the real purpose or design of financial education? And really what that meant or was extended into, and I think what we saw from the Black women that participated in this study was that it's obvious, but it really rings true that financial education was not designed to help manage financial trauma. And so with that particular maxim coming through as a theme, The real question then becomes, should financial education be designed to help manage financial trauma? And can it? The can it is certainly more aspirational. I think anything can be anything if we work hard enough. But the real question is, should it be? And to help add even more texture to this question that I'd like us to kind of talk about out loud is bringing in, to your point, what you mentioned, Josh, about our literature review, where we really felt as though it was not only necessary to get people to understand why Black women are such a great and important group to centralize this question around, but equally, we wanted to ensure that people understood that, one, financial trauma is not a pathology, or at least the way that we are approaching it, right? So we can understand in the broader kind of world or research world why financial trauma could be treated as such because of, again, to your point, the intersection of health and financial experiences and things like that. But we kind of took the approach of if we treat financial trauma as a pathology, we're essentially asking people what is wrong with them when they make certain financial choices as opposed to what happened to them. So I guess when we're grounded in that central theme or understanding of our work that financial trauma is not a pathology, how do we then go about thinking about this idea that we saw a number of women who went through very difficult experiences on a personal level that influenced and colored the ways that they then showed up and participating in the broader economy? Many of the women, as we discussed internally, ended up developing philosophies around money that they would consider to be a source of their own shame, where they felt as though they were replicating behaviors that they saw their previous generations that taught them their own money behaviors. And it felt like they were continuing a cycle that they really, really were keen on breaking. And right, that was another really central theme in what we saw from these women was that, Josh, you and I talked about the word over-efforting. There is this deep, intentional desire to break a cycle, to do better financially, which I think is something that everybody can kind of agree with, particularly when you bring up, you know, feeling like you have a commitment to advancing the next generation into a better economic position than your own. But this idea of when something adverse happened, and then it seemed to be cyclical and repetitive for these Black women that we engaged with, many of them sought out, quote unquote, financial education as a tool to try to reduce the harm that they were experiencing. And then what we ended up finding was that there was still this very vast disappointment that on the one hand, they felt in the moment that, yes, I'm getting knowledge, I'm developing my own savvy on how to navigate this economic system. But then there was kind of this moment where they felt the limitations of what financial education can do in the context of how do I participate in this economy that was designed to be violent towards me. And so it brings me again to this question I just want to again have this conversation around is, if financial education was not originally designed to help people navigate and manage their own financial trauma, should it?
The short answer is yes. We have an obligation, we have a duty as professionals, whether you're in a nonprofit or not, to really help individuals who need it the most. I personally identify under the LGBTQ umbrella, and so I constantly think about what's going on. Not that, you know, we are the only individuals or group or community that are going through atrocities in our life, but I like to compare it because out of the entire acronym, the trans part or transgender individuals or non-gender conforming individuals are the ones who have the most sort of oppression that takes place. That's not to take away from anyone else that's under that umbrella, but this becomes really important when we're looking at our resources and our strategies of who we want to help and uplift first, knowing, because the research is very clear about this, that when you concentrate on that, it doesn't just help them, it helps everyone else. And so there is a good reason for the focus. And in this case, we're talking about Black women. And Black women are not a monolith, and neither are transgender individuals. And when you start to break down, guess what? We see that Black trans women are the ones who are having the worst outcomes.
Exactly.
That is sort of how I connect things in my mind, because my lived experience is not that of a Black woman, obviously. So what I try to do is just try to understand how to connect things and why it's so important that we just focus all of our resources as much as humanly possible or institutionally possible on that. With this, should we or should we not? I think it's not even a question in my mind. It is, this is what we have to do.
Yes.
And that's just how I see it.
And Michael, same question, but I'm almost thinking about if you could share with us early on when we were thinking about creating our hypotheses, which I hate to say that they, you know, clearly were true based on what's in the data, but I think that that's unsurprising, but helpful to know that what we are thinking rings true. Early on when we were creating these hypotheses, you kind of brought up a number of scholars who talk about the decommodification in political economy spaces. Can you help answer this question, but bring in some of that work here? Because I think that's deeply rooted in this question too.
Yeah, absolutely. To sort of begin by just offering a high level sort of agreement to the question of whether or not financial education ought to or can take into account financial trauma, you know, wholehearted agreement that I think that any financial education that merits, right, a description as quality or effective absolutely has to reflect the actual experience of participating in the economy of the people in our society, including the people that are the most marginalized and face the most barriers to financial and economic well-being. This is a mission that NEFI is very strongly committed to, and we know that creating a society where everyone has the best chance to live like their best financial lives requires this. It requires taking seriously how financial education can have the highest impact, which includes taking seriously the actual experiences of trauma and marginalization and systemic inequality that are faced by many communities in this country. And so I just sort of posit that by saying that that follows from that insight that financial education, to the extent that it can be a tool of empowerment, just like education of any type, right? Part of its function is to offer protection, empowerment, support, insight to people that operate within an economic system that is not set up for regular people. It's not set up to support regular people. That's not the goal of the organization of our economy. The organization of our economy, the goal is to create profit. And so there's a certain sense in which we already know that quote unquote regular people, right? People who have to work for a living, are facing a different set of challenges and a different set of incentives. And financial education as it exists completely recognizes this and understands it because in many ways it's influenced by a very sort of economistic way of thinking. Now, the connection to financial trauma specifically as being a blind spot within that legacy of financial education is that there's oftentimes not a very well-developed language, which you know so well, Chloe, because you that's sort of the project that you have engaged yourself in as a traumaographer, as you said, right? Is thinking, how does our language of financial life, of existence and engagement with the economy, how can it be expanded to include that set of experiences that don't conform to the sort of textbook example of how people ought to act, or even how educated or informed people ought to act? That's sort of a traditional model of financial education is oriented in taking that approach, especially one that's been really influenced by a more economistic sort of way of thinking. And to your point then about political economy, and especially the literature that focuses on decommodification, the insight here is to say, well, historically speaking, we have had a really long set of institutional development that has been inspired by the idea that it might not be the case that we want people, individuals, households, to have to rely on the market mechanism to provide all of the things that they need in order to, first off, just be able to reproduce themselves as working people to participate as actors in the economy. But then next, to live their best lives, right? To flourish, to be economically secure, things that society as a whole benefits from. That, in many ways, as a very simplistic level, is sort of the description of why advanced modern dynamic economies have welfare states, right? It's this understanding that the market is not able to provide people with the amount of food, of housing, of income, and some countries, right, childcare, healthcare, things that people need in order to live their best lives and to flourish. So decommodification describes essentially the extent to which some societies say, well, some of these critical human needs are not best provided by the market, and instead they're provided by, you know, the state, by other types of social actors, in some cases a sort of partnership between the state and other social actors like unions or corporations or social service organizations. And their patterns of this, of course, are very different across the advanced industrialized world. But thinking through what it means to say some things that people need in order to survive and to flourish, we want to make sure that they have them, have access to them as a part and parcel of their citizenship and their membership in the community. What that allows us to see, to think about how decommodification operates differently within different societies, is to problematize in many ways one of the longstanding assumptions in the financial literacy and financial education space, which is thinking about the individual role, the role of individual choices, of individual decision making in acquiring, having access to, in getting the things that you need in order to live a financially secure life. And what I mean by that is that, you know, it's not giving us an easy answer about what that ought to look like in any given society. But what it does show is that in our country, in the United States, we have a particular image of what a financially secure or a quote-unquote financially responsible person looks like. What does that person's finances, what does that person's financial situation entail? And then we think about the choices that they might need to make or the behaviors that they might need to engage in that can help them maximize their opportunity of getting that. What thinking about the way that other institutions in society interact with those choices and interact with people's individual opportunity to get that financial security is a way for us to open up this conversation about how specifically traumatic, longstanding negative experiences with the economy, with financial institutions, at the individual, household, at the community level, fundamentally break, really, like the relationship between people's individual choices and their individual behaviors and their ability to get that financial security. And that's why we have to take seriously the influence of those traumatic experiences. Do I believe that financial education can appropriately sort of address that? One thing I definitely believe is that I definitely believe that education has a lot of capacity and power to improve people's lives. And I do believe that that includes financial education. If we think about this, again, as a tool of empowering people to move through and engage with an economy that was not set up for them, with them in mind, I think that there's a lot of space for financial education if it takes seriously that not everybody is coming into the economy with the same background and the same experiences, the same capacity to make a certain set of choices because of their own personal experiences. It has a lot of work to do in order to get there, but it absolutely can and it should. But, and Josh, I know will agree with me on this, this is still a multifaceted approach, right? And we can't put all of the burden on educators, either in the classroom or social service organizations, at people's jobs, to take on the burden of trying to, as you had said, Chloe, not address some sort of fundamental problem that people have by having traumatic experiences, but helping empower, guide, and in some cases, right, you think about mental health professionals or other health professionals, in some cases to provide healing, right, for people to be able to talk through, to diagnose, to address and name the trauma that they've experienced. And that sort of symbiotic relationship between the education piece of it and all of the other issues that are necessary, that also has to be taken into account. And then the last thing, really, I'll just say there, and this is why the personal finance ecosystem is such a useful tool and why, you know, we're really, really thinking about in the next, you know, years to come about how we can continue to expand that tool, is that this also has to include thinking about the role of structural policy choices and institutions that are kind of fundamentally outside of the conversation about how education can empower somebody at an individual level. And one of the things that we've talked about a lot, how this connects to financial trauma, not just some of the things I mentioned, you know, in terms of my own interest about economic crisis, but there's a sociologist named Melinda Cooper, who's wrote an excellent book called Family Values, which details a lot of the contradictory nature of the choices and behaviors that we like to prioritize, that we like to hold out as being ideal at the individual and household level, and how those are so often contradictory with the goals of profit maximization that our economy is set up to pursue. And how do individual people navigate those contradictions? To put not too fine a point on it, plenty of people in this space, you talk to anybody who works with real people, knows that those contradictions are how people experience their financial lives always. They always experience this contradiction. They know on the one hand that austerity at the household level, adhering to a budget, making certain financial choices is really important in achieving financial security. But they also know that the economy functions because of their spending and because of the things that they buy. And they see the impact of that in their own community, especially when there's an economic crisis. They know that, like, oh no, this is bad that people aren't spending and buying things.
Mm-hmm.
Navigating through those contradictions, I do think there's a role for financial education in helping people be prepared to think about existing in a society that puts those contradictory pressures on them. And I think a lot of our work in this project is sort of showing at a particular city level, like how that functions.
You know, this reminds me of in doing the early work before we actually started the study itself, we created a new iteration of our conceptual definition of financial trauma that expands Maria Root, who is a feminist scholar, her conceptualization of what she calls insidious trauma. And it's a form of trauma that people experience because of the intrinsic characteristics to their identity. So because, Chloe McKenzie, I am a Black woman, I am going to experience the world a lot differently than you two per se. But the trauma that I experience is because of the characteristics intrinsic to my identity. And we do think that that is an important thing that needs to show up in our understandings of financial trauma, one, but certainly even more so needs to show up in how that's reflected back in financial education. And so we had this conversation that blew my mind. You know, I'm a mom to three. Motherhood, Black motherhood specifically, was a huge theme in our work. Again, to kind of take the next step from what we've already talked about is, and I can speak as a Black mom, but I'm also just letting everybody know I've been endowed with the ability to speak on behalf of the Black woman that we partnered with in this research, right? Because one of the things that we grounded ourselves in is a number of work around making sure that we become the storytellers of people whose stories are often overlooked. So I'm doing that here, where in traditional contexts, Black motherhood serves as a mechanism to pass down strategies of really resilience and survival against oppressive forces. And that was so central to pretty much every single Black woman's socioeconomic experiences that we were able to engage with in this study. Not every single participant was a Black mother. However, overwhelmingly, they were. But we also know that mothering and mother work is something that does not necessitate you birthing a child. That particularly in the Black community, again, speaking as a Black woman, we feel as though this work is about how we socialize the next generation to be able to hopefully more effectively navigate the oppressive forces that unfortunately, maybe not in our lifetime, we're going to be able to dismantle and leave something better. And the reason why I bring this up alongside the insidious trauma is, again, Josh, you and I came up with the idea that we're seeing so much, not just effort, but over-efforting to try to outwork the system, outsmart the system, that it oftentimes leads to this intense exhaustion, which then leads to another iteration of our financial trauma definition around non-participation, right? Just choosing to almost completely remove yourself as much as you can from having to participate in the economy because the experience is so traumatic. We keep talking about over-efforting. This was something that I feel like I had to name over time because I just saw it so much that on the one hand, I looked at non-participation as one of the indicators of financial trauma. But what would it look like to explore the fact that when I saw in the data people were over-participating, what does that even mean? In 1983, a group of researchers coined the phrase and developed the theory on John Henryism. It is defined as an individual's self-perception that he can meet the demands of his environment through hard work and determination. John Henry is the central figure in a Black American folk ballad that describes Henry's competition with the steam drill, in which he cleared more rock than the machine did. And after completing this task, he died almost instantly with his hammer in his hand, as the song goes, because his heart exploded from such hard work. Especially in the Black community, but also among many others, John Henry remains an important figure. He is a symbol of the all-too-familiar consequences of facing subjugation and trying to overcome it in a white supremacist, pull-yourself-up-by-your-bootstraps, individualistic meritocracy mentality. The team of researchers also found how the misguided perception core to John Henryism is associated with serious health impacts, such as higher levels of blood pressure and overactive nervous systems. And so in the context of financial trauma and the work that I've been doing, I decided to actually use this conceptualization in the context of financial trauma and created the concept of financial John Henryism. I define that as the behavior of trying to outwork the economic system by practicing hypervigilance or overparticipation, like monitoring one's bank account or feeling the need to participate more frequently than you otherwise would in financial interactions in order to secure, restore, and/or maintain financial security, or more importantly, material safety. And this over-efforting, again, in the Black women's perspective, seems to rub up against another oftentimes trope, but sometimes like real identity for Black women, which is that we save everything. We were meant to save democracy. We're supposed to save our children, which is a huge thread and theme that has been embedded in our bodies since slavery, right? Like our children were stripped from us, but we still had to protect the next generation. And so I think what we're seeing where financial education showed up for these Black women, there was an excitement initially to say, now I'm going to have the skills to then pass down, right, to the next generation as a strategy of survival and hopefully a strategy to more successfully navigate the economic system that was not designed for us. But again, there was this wall almost that many of the women felt as though they said that they hit. And so I think what was really interesting is a little teaser to the audience to, you know, make sure you engage with our research when it comes out in early 2025. But I felt as though that really when we aggregate all of the narratives and the stories and the insights and the gleanings from the women that we engaged with and partnered with in this work, this is really a story about becoming a Black woman financially. What does it actually mean to be a Black woman in a socioeconomic context in America? There are many different scholars, but we certainly relied on Amber Tucker to kind of help us think about that there are just different moments and different what she calls embodied processes of becoming. And one thing that we do think is fundamentally missing in financial education is the infusion of understanding that there are processes and chronologies or stories or whatever you want to call them that are embodied in our socioeconomic experiences that help us become something in the socioeconomic context. So Josh, thinking about the expertise you bring to this, and we talked about origin stories and all of these things. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. In terms of how we identify, I think that's one of the aspects that I love to touch upon. There's been a lot of work as to how you identify with something. There are mainstays in our life, such as identifying as a Black woman is pretty much not going to change over the course of your life. but there are other aspects, and motherhood would be another example of that. But there are other aspects of identity that can change or actually change its focus. So you could identify as an example as a runner, but when the day comes, perhaps, that you can't run anymore, to use this analogy, you are faced with this sort of loss of part of your identity, which could actually be very detrimental to your mental health. So you're squared away with a decision to make, such as using something like a tool like the five whys is very helpful, because you get to the underlying mechanism as to what is actually operating and motivating you to want to pursue something like running. And you could apply this to anything in your financial life as well. The way that that works is that you analyze it, look at the underlying sort of mechanism, and then change your identity to be something along the lines of, like, I just want to be a healthier person. In the case of finances, it could be, well, I don't need to save everything and everyone in the world. What is underlying that mechanism? What is motivating me? And how can I figure out and forge different ways to do the same thing that's underlying that, but in ways that are not going to take away from my mental health and my ability to flourish, whether that be financially or otherwise, because we know all of it is intertwined and all of it is connected. So by focusing on one aspect alone, you're actually affecting the rest of those aspects in terms of your well-being, general or otherwise. There's a couple of other things as well. One thing is in the helping relationships sphere, if you will. A lot of the meta-analyses point to helping relationships. And now in psychology, this is really focused more on the therapeutic relationship, but these outcomes have been applied to other types of relationships as well. But usually about 20 to 30% of the variance is accounted for in that helping relationship. And what does that mean? If the outcome that you're looking for is human betterment, human well-being, you can say with certainty that about 20 to 30% of that is created through the helping relationship. And what does that mean? Well, I love putting numbers on things, although you don't want to get too tied to a number, but it helps put things into perspective. Obviously, that means there's about 70% of the variance that is not accounted for through that helping relationship. And so then it becomes our challenge, if you will, from an industry standpoint or otherwise, to really dig deep and find out, again, going back to something like the ecosystem, we know that financial education by itself is not going to change everything that's needed in terms of the knowledge, the self-efficacy, the behaviors that all need to change. And then looking into, although we focus a lot on the individual level, it's still a very important thing, but we don't want to be an all or nothing. Like, it's not only at the individual level, it's also all these other aspects at the institutional level. We look at things like resilience and prosilience. And the difference is really that resilience is the ability to deal with high levels of disruption, difficulty, challenges that exist, whether that be through your finances or just generally speaking. Prosilience, on the other hand, is our ability to do that in a proactive nature, so that we're not just waiting for the event to take place, living through it, and then reacting to it. And you need both. So there are like four building blocks of resilience that I love to talk about. And those would be like calming yourself down, figuring out ways to lower your anxiety and your emotionality so that you can be more logical about your decision-making, which is easier said than done. But these tactics can be very helpful, because when we're highly emotional, that's when we're not able to really, it hijacks our ability to be super clear and logical. Then we need to be able to select really effective strategies in our life. And this can come through helping relationships. It can happen through education, financial education, obviously, as well as helping to solve problems. And this is the one that I really love, especially in this day and time, is building and sustaining energy. It's being really strategic about the things that we care about. There's a book that I won't say the full name, but it's something about the art of giving an F. Outside of it being kind of lewd with the title, I found this book to be so profound, because although I was taught this during my doctoral journey, it's something that really resonates with me. When we're spending our time and spinning our wheels on things that really are not giving us the outcomes that we need to be effective and to flourish as we should. I love the concept of financial flourishing, which is still in its infancy and hasn't been fleshed out. The reason why I like it so much is because that's what we really want. We want to flourish. And there are plenty of models, like the model of well-being, which is called PERMA or PERMA-V. And this keeps coming back up in my life because when we look at a model like that, how do we, and I won't go into all the aspects of it. I just think we just don't have time. We could spend a whole hour just on that. But my point is that these things are out there. And this is part of the work that we do outside of that 30% that I talk about. It's like all these other things that culminate into us helping each other, ourselves, our families, our communities, and otherwise to really move the needle on financial well-being. Because it's so, so important. You can't do it if you're just singularly focused on what's wrong with this individual and how do I fix them. Mm-hmm. That's not how we're going to get there.
And to that point, I think about one of our earliest conversations where I think we're still even workshopping this now, but part of one of the, let's call it byproducts or effects of financial trauma, you know, if we're the, let's call the architects of the system, we would say that this would be a success because we know that the system was designed to have outcomes only for certain people to concentrate wealth. So the quote unquote success, but really what's causing the one of the traumas in the first place is there seems to almost be this dependency, right? We're still trying to workshop the kind of semantics of it, but it is important for the system to continue to work as it is that financial trauma becomes self-perpetuating. And so this is why we bring up shame, right? The idea that the socioeconomic harm that we experience is our fault. Particularly with the Black woman that we studied, and this totally resonated with me, again, and the intersection of motherhood and the historical context of Black women birth so much of the wealth in this country. We also, again, have structured our identities both because by choice and because it was thrust upon us. We structured our identities as a way that we need to make sure that we are protecting at all costs the next generation, which again, we know is a central theme and narrative from slavery. We felt as a theme this intense desire to break the cycle of, we're inserting our own words here, financial trauma into the next generation. And the fact that so many Black women felt like they couldn't do that, it disrupted their identity as the superwoman, as the person who can protect their children from this force that they're, you know, trying to do. And we talked about this as an adjacent analogy almost to, you know, police violence, for example, right? That it's like, we can have the talk, I can tell you to put your hands on the wheel and say, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, you know, whatever, but we still can't deal. The outcome is still outside of our control. That seems to be something that's happening in the socioeconomic context. And so, Michael, I'm thinking about our conversation where in thinking about all of these things, this the self-perpetuating cycle of financial trauma and how that ultimately, right, you even brought it up with the decommodification stuff, that it's like, the markets itself need that cycle of financial trauma to perpetuate itself so that the market can continue to thrive as it was designed. You know, what do we kind of do with that? We're chewing on that and we're seeing the real impact that that's having because that showed up with the Black women that we partnered with in this research. So I think there's that side of it. But equally, it also brought to light what you and I talked about, that financial precarity is not a predictor of financial trauma. Now, of course, if you are coming from a lower socioeconomic positioning, you are probably more likely, you know, given the research that we've done and others have done, to experience financial trauma. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to meet some income or wealth threshold and you're going to be completely immune from the experience of financial trauma. That's also, as we know, not how trauma works. Like, you can be out of the actual violent event and it's still, and years later, right? And you can still feel as though it's happening to you there as well. So I think that connects the dots there. But Michael, can we kind of talk about that? This idea of the self-perpetuating cycle and how much that was the awareness that the Black women in our study had about that. But again, feeling though it was so damaging and disruptive to their own well-being because, to your point, Josh, it was disruptive to how they identified as what their role was, and they're wanting to be successful in their commitment to protecting their children, the next generation. Talk out loud about me with that, Michael and Josh, of course.
Yeah, I have two primary thoughts that I really want to kind of get out there. And the first of them is the ways in which the self-perpetuating nature of this trauma is so deeply connected to, either intentional or unintentional, the ways that people then reproduce their own negative experiences by the ways that they have to move through, the ways they feel they have, the feel they have to move through the world economically and financially. And I think that you bring up this point that's so key, is that obviously we know that financial precarity, like more precarious objective financial circumstances, are a big predictor of that, but it's not the only one. Meaning that people's, their family financial socialization, their race, their class, their gender, everything we've talked about here perpetuates, the trauma perpetuates even when the higher levels of financial security are reached. I mean, it's a huge reason at just a basic level why thinking about well-being rather than some objective measure of security is just a foundational factor. But I want to think about how the felt need to continue to make those positive decisions for fear, right, that they will experience, particularly Black women, but any community that is marginalized will experience the consequences of a negative choice in a greater way than other people. And we know this to be true, right? We do know this to be true, that that is one of the things that perpetuates that economic precarity within those marginalized communities the most, is the lack of a sufficient financial and economic cushion that wealthier stratas of society, the higher classes, but also non-marginalized races and genders, right? White people, white men in particular, there's just more of a cushion there. So the anxiety of feeling the consequences of your choices in a greater way than others is a psychological and mental and emotional trauma that cannot be removed just by making better choices or making choices that then lead to more financial security. And given the fact that we know this to be true, I mean, one of the things that I'm thinking about is this finding that we saw so extensively in the city of St. Paul with the women that we spoke to. And you had mentioned this earlier, Chloe, about this overaction, this feeling that there is some amount of activity that I can do that will provide a protection for myself and my family. And if I just can do that, right? And we called out specifically the astronomical amount of time that people reported monitoring their financial situation.
Yes.
And then combined with what people are telling us about why they do that, feeling this anxiety of, I need to make sure that everything is there the way that it's supposed to be.
So just as we went over the idea of financial John Henryism, what I was seeing in some of the data was that a number of Black women were spending so much time monitoring their bank accounts, sometimes to the tune of more than 30 hours per week. And again, even if that's not even true, at first, of course, I thought maybe I wrote a bad question, but it ended up being statistically significant. The idea that I thought about was, perhaps even if this wasn't actually true, that they were spending more than 30 hours a week monitoring their bank accounts, the fact that they perceive that they were spending so much time monitoring their bank accounts is a huge indicator of financial trauma at play as well.
That I'm getting paid the way I'm supposed to be, that the debits and the payments for my bills and my other expenses are coming out the way that they need, that I'm not missing something, right? And this is so connected to what you were saying, Chloe, about that feeling of that burden of responsibility of saving, right, my own situation, saving my family's situation. And there's a way in which you can think about that as being a really powerful expression of self-efficacy, taking response, quote unquote, responsibility, the type of thing that we tend to prize, right, in our society. But this makes me think of, you know, a really great sort of strain of research by Elizabeth Cohen, as a political scientist at Boston University, and a book that she wrote called The Political Value of Time. You know, she was writing specifically in that research agenda on immigration and citizenship. I think that in many ways, sort of the insights or the framework that she offers is really relevant in an economic sense as well, which is just essentially that our society and the institutions that structure our society value some people's time over others, right? You think about in the United States, and we discussed this, of course, in the city of St. Paul as well, people in America in general, unless you live in one of the three or four major cities in America that have really functioning public transportation, even then, it's not really always functioning. Being in a situation where you have to take the bus means that your time is being used in a fundamentally different way from someone else that either maybe has the opportunity or the financial security to afford driving a car, paying for the insurance, paying for the gas, et cetera. And in the same way, one of the things that we know to be true is that people that have the ability, the opportunity, the financial security to engage with the formal financial system that have bank accounts, that don't have to spend a lot of time waiting in line, cashing a check at a check casher, that don't have to spend a lot of mental and cognitive energy dealing with the interest rate payments on a payday loan, trying to figure out how that functions and fits into their finances, are paying off a lot of installment loans if they need to lease their furniture or appliances, these other types of things that we know that people that are in precarious financial circumstances are more likely to have to rely on. That's time, right? That's time and that's energy that they have to expend on managing their financial situation that someone that's better off doesn't have to. And so we need to think about like the relationship between people's individual sense that they're in control of their circumstances and they want to try to manage that for themselves and their families with a set of institutions that are always trying to claim more and more of their time and more of their cognitive energy, especially related to finances, and how that can't help but perpetuate this cycle, right, of feeling like you're not doing enough, even when in fact you're actually doing quite a bit more than another person similarly situated that doesn't face the financial challenges and the financial barriers that you do. So that's sort of one thought. And then as to sort of end on more of a positive and empowering note and to bring this back to financial education, I mean, one of the possible visions of financial education is to think about it as creating a vision of people as financial citizens, right? What it means to create an understanding of financial citizenship, where financial education can play a really important role in building a foundation for people to advocate for themselves and for their communities for the value of their time, right? The value of their emotional and cognitive energy, the financial security of their families. And I think this is a really powerful vision of financial education, that there's more space and more room to continue to advocate for that. Of course, financial education has this connection to improve people's behavior, improve people's choices that then can lead to greater financial security. But there's also a sense in which, and this is not just for the most marginalized in our society either. I mean, I think that you raised the point about the movement for Black Lives. And one of the things that we saw in the incredibly powerful demonstration of solidarity in 2020 is that the movement for Black Lives then included not Black people.
Right?
That's what made those protests in the summer of 2020 so powerful and compelling. And so financial citizenship is not just right something to think about financial education producing in communities that themselves are feeling marginalized. It's about producing a feeling of solidarity among everybody that we all deserve to live our best financial lives, that we all deserve financial security. And financial education, I think, has a potential role to play in that as well, to give people the tools that they need to advocate for better, for more from their financial institutions, for more from their financial lives, whatever they might look like. That's kind of where my thoughts are at with that. What about you, Josh?
I love these points. Thank you so much for bringing them up. We recently at NEFI went to the AFCPE annual conference, which is the Association for Financial Counseling and Planning Education. One of the mainstays or themes that I had as a takeaway was that we need more financial advocacy. And I thought that was such a great point. And at one point, one of the speeches that was given talked about the junk food industry and how we know for certain that the industry has a vested interest in making sure that people eat more junk food, not less. It's set up in a way to where the system kind of encapsulates people and keeps them in there. And it can become, for a lot of people, actually, a deleterious cycle where they're actually using psychology against us in order to keep us spending. And the financial services sector is no different, although, you know, saying that out loud might ruffle some feathers, but it's the actual truth. I mean,
right. The
stat that is now maybe about 6 or 7 years old, but I think is still beneficial to talk about, is that hundreds of millions of dollars is spent on financial education. Sounds like a lot of money until you compare it to the billions of dollars that is spent for marketing to keep us spending. And so by understanding that, yeah, it could be a little daunting just to think about it, but it's also helpful. So once you get past processing the negative emotions that are associated with that, then it becomes, okay, so what can I do about this now that I know? Because it can make you angry to be thinking about that. Let's not glaze over that, right? Once we process that anger, and it could take a while, then we need to figure out strategies that are going to really help us, because we're up against the machine. And so we do what we possibly can. And every time we do engage, we need to have limitations. We need to say, okay, I'm going to have these cheese doodles, if you will. I'm only going to have half a bag. But then it's also knowing oneself, right? And knowing the family unit, if you're engaged in one. Is it really truly something that can happen? Can you really stop at half the bag? I know there are people who are prone to certain diseases that perhaps might have an issue with only eating half the bag. And so then that becomes more of a determination to withdraw altogether. You know, this happens with financial trauma, where people say, I've had enough, where I've hit the hot stove, if you will, with my hand, and I just can't. I can't keep doing this to myself. And so it's important to acknowledge that so that we understand and can meet people where they're at, and then help them, if they're ready and willing, to find out ways to re-engage in ways that are very healthy for them. And I think that's what it's all about. Simultaneously, we also need to be advocating for change at the policy level. And NIFI is really good at doing this, because although we're fairly new in this aspect of our work, it's still super important to us. And I'm so happy that NIFI has decided to be strategic about advocating for policy change. And one of the ways we've done this is through K-12 education, but that's not the only way, obviously. And we have to start somewhere. So that's where we're at. The last thing I'll mention is, when you start to understand people, this notion of proximity, it becomes very important, because these stories really help us to change these notions of, oh, well, they maybe deserve these negative consequences. You know, we start to judge, shame, blame them. And then we understand why they're overcorrecting.
Yes.
Why somebody who's been harmed for the majority of their life is protecting, has a protective mechanism in place. Then we could just figure out ways of helping them to tap into what's underlying that, those mechanisms that are motivating them, to figure out ways to do it so that they can actually flourish instead of diminish.
Yes. Well, it's funny how you all made this full circle, and I'm kind of reminded of S.R. Tolliver's work, where she mentions that it's often the communities, and this is again why we picked Black women to begin with, that are overlooked and underutilized in us trying to be able to kind of understand what needs to be done in order to maximize impact and create the greatest amount of change, is that these communities have what she calls an encoded cultural knowledge and memory. And I think that that's ultimately what our work has done, right? It is, we've taken that encoded cultural knowledge and memory of really what imprint financial trauma is leaving on larger communities. And we're taking that to ultimately shine a light on the gaps in financial education that we actually can fill in. And I think that this is a full circle moment, right? Our podcast is called Silence is Violence. Is that's the silent part, saying it out loud, and what Josh did, right? That there's a level of courageousness and even audacity that we have to be able to say that we have to name the parts that aren't working. And not only that they're not working because maybe we haven't figured it out, maybe there's not enough literature, we agree with that, this is why we're doing some of the research. But some of the gaps are choices that are limiting us probably because of the fear. And that when we can leverage our own privilege in whatever kind of form or fashion that looks like, to name the silent parts out loud, it not only certainly helps lift those who are most impacted by economic violence and other forms of oppression, but it actually helps everybody. So Josh, Michael, another nerd session in the books. I deeply, deeply appreciate our time together. And for those of you listening, if you want to continue to engage with our brains, because I obviously love to, please look out for our research project that is coming out specifically about the Black woman we partnered with on this research in St. Paul. There will be a number of resources that you can leverage. Our analysis protocol, which is kind of our way of helping to guide other folks who might want to do research like this. The helping professionals who can take our insights and infuse them into your own practice. And then obviously the report itself on what we need to learn from these Black women who have really helped us better understand what financial trauma is, and most importantly, what it does to us. So thank you both for your time, and thank you, listeners.
Thank you.
Such a pleasure. Thank you so much, Chloe.
Next time on Silence is Violence, Stories of Financial Education, we'll shift our focus to the present moment and potential for the future.
Silence is Violence, Stories of Financial Education is produced by the National Endowment for Financial Education, a 501c3 nonprofit that is the independent, centralizing voice providing leadership, research, and collaboration to advance financial education and financial well-being. The opinions and statements made on this podcast are those of the podcast participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of NEFI or constitute statements supported by NEFI. Links to our event summaries and any other documents discussed in this session are available in the show notes. For more information, visit www.nefi.org.